Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you've tuned in. We're going to make it worth your while because David Sedaris is in town workshopping his new book on stage for a week at Broadway Performance Hall, and he's here. Welcome back to KUOW.
Thank you, Bill.
What are you writing over and over and over?
These are called tip-ins, and so when a new book comes out, they bind them into the book, so I have to write my name on 8,000 sheets of paper, and I am so angry about it.
Angry?
Oh, it takes forever to do it.
You're David Sedaris. Can't you say no?
Yeah, let me tell you a little something about books now, right? I mean, just from the time that I started writing books, the landscape has changed so much, right? Just in terms of how books are sold and whatnot. So now it seems like when your book comes out, it's you have to do everything, right? Whereas the marketing department used to say, we'll do this and this. Now that a marketing department says, do you have a Twitter account? You need to have a Twitter account. You need to have an Instagram account. You need to do this. And you need to sign 8,000. So it just feels like you're the one who's doing everything.
What do you do with your anger? You just suck it up and write 8,000. You're just writing over and over again your
name.
That's
a really good question. And it just takes forever and there's no end to it.
Huh. You know, you wrote me a note. The first time we ever met, I interviewed you, must have been 20 years ago, and you typed me a note, and you asked me whether I had been, I went to an Ivy League school, and I think you meant it in a complimentary way, but you're David Sedaris. I know people always fear that you're judging them, I assume, because of your acerbic wit, right? You don't hear that from people, that they think you're going to be judging me because...
You know, I always wondered, we had some house guests over Christmas, and at one point, one of the guests was writing in his diary, and I thought, oh, that's what that feels like. You know, we were on a train, and he was across the aisle from me. And when you see somebody writing in your diary, I guess you think, oh, they're writing about me. But they're not, 9 times out of 10, but it does make you a little bit nervous,
yeah.
I think.
Well, I took it as I appreciated that. It's a personal touch. But we don't even know that it's your signature. I mean, couldn't you just put this on a machine?
They didn't. If they'd offered me that option, I would have taken it.
Uh-huh.
Here's what I don't think is fair.
What?
Okay. Is that I go on book tours, right? And I'll go to like 30 cities in 30 days on a book tour, right? My record for signing books in one night is 10 and a half hours, right? So it's not like I don't do that. If I didn't do that and they said, we want you to sign 8,000 tip-ins, okay, maybe. Mm. But I do that. So I just don't think it's fair that I have to sign these 8,000 tip-ins on top of it.
Are you going to be still frustrated and angry by the time you're on stage tonight? You're doing a show tonight? Broadway Performance Hall?
Yeah.
Okay. You're workshopping a book. You did this last year. You were in Seattle. Is it the same idea?
Yeah, I think I've done this, I don't know, 7 or 8, maybe not 7 or 8. I think I started doing it with Me Talk Pretty one day. And what I would do is before I turned the book in, I would book myself into a theater that's 200 to 300 seats, and it would be billed as a work in progress. And I would take the stories that I was having a problem with, and I'd read them out loud and go back to the room and rewrite them and read them and rewrite them and read them and rewrite them over the course of a week and see if I could get them into shape. And that's what I'm doing. I did it last year.
Same place, Broadway Performance.
Yeah. And it was for Theft by Finding, which is a collection of diary entries.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you can rewrite the diary entries, but I would just read them out loud and then think, okay, maybe I could shorten this a bit. Or I would think, this is really not worth it.
But all you can hear is laugh or no laugh. How can you tell how your written word is going over with a live audience?
It sounds kind of kumbaya, but you can feel people drifting away from you.
Uh-huh.
Often, like this morning, I sat down with some notes I took yesterday when I was reading a story, and I just had skulls driven, you know, drawn in the margins, and it was just like Death Valley. I'd entered Death Valley, and people, I just felt them like, they came back later, but they drifted away. And it was something I had added, a story that Hugh's sister told me. And it didn't really go anywhere, and it just sort of wasn't terribly interesting. And so that's the thing. I was glad I had an opportunity to read it out loud, so I learned, oh, that didn't work.
Right. How does Hugh feel about being you can just say Hugh and millions of people know you're talking about your boyfriend.
Yeah. I mean, Hugh's a pretty private person, but for some reason he doesn't mind that. But that said, I don't really, I'm not terribly personal about him.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I give the illusion
of
being terribly personal, but like I don't write about our sex life or I don't write about, you know, everybody's got things I don't want people knowing.
Yeah.
So I don't write about those things, and he trusts me not to.
So you really are workshopping the book. This isn't just marketing, because marketing makes you do all kinds of crazy things. But you're actually come to Seattle, and you'll take our feedback in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it was interesting last night. I wrote a story about a board game called Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
And
I know Sorry.
So somebody came last night, and they said, you said that your sister-in-law sent your player home, but what you meant was sent your player back to start. I said, thank you so much.
That is a key detail.
Thank you so much, because that's something that my editor had looked at that story already, but I don't know, and maybe the copy editor would have noticed that, but the editor didn't notice it. And then there was something else.
It changes the vibe. I mean, getting sent back home is one thing, but sending all the way back to start, that's as awful as it feels in Sorry.
Right. But plus, it's just a mistake. It would have been a mistake in the book.
Oh.
So I was so glad that that woman pointed it out. And then somebody else pointed out something last night, too, that I was really, I don't like to beg, you know, the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to fish for compliments from them or anything.
Mm.
But, you know, last night I read something and at the end of the story, I said, you know what, I think I'm going to cut that bit out. And the audience was like, yeah, you really should cut that bit out.
In Seattle?
Yeah.
Really? That's nice. Because I would think you get a lot of worship, which isn't necessarily helpful to you.
Well, when I read it out loud, I realized the Washington Post has an article where they send two people on a date, right? And then they catch up with them and ask how the date went.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote this piece about being 5'5", right? And recently the couple was gay that they sent on a date. And they had at the top of the column, there's deal breakers.
Uh-huh. Right?
And both of them had short men. None of them had white supremacists. None of them had machine gun owners.
Yeah.
Right? But short men.
That's beyond the pale.
Was a deal breaker.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd written that both of these guys had gay face. And then my editor, her note was like, what's gay face?
Yeah,
so I sent her some pictures. It's like, you know, like when you look at a poster for the Chippendales dancers and you look at them and it's just so clear that they're gay. They have gay face. It looks like someone put Vaseline on their eyeballs and their teeth and they just shine. Their face shine a bit too much.
This is just a celebrity, a marketing gay face, or are you saying there's more regular gay face?
Well, you either have gay face or you don't.
Okay.
But
I don't think you have gay face. Do you have gay face?
I don't have gay face.
Okay.
But both these guys had gay face.
All right.
But my editor didn't know what gay face was, and then a lot of the audience didn't know what gay face was, and then the way that I had talked about it, it was just sort of an aside to kind of attack somebody. And I thought, you know what, I don't really need it. And I kind of suspected that, but the audience verified it. And so I thought, great, gone.
Lose the gay face.
Yeah, lose the gay face.
Okay.
But I think you could probably Google gay face and they'll give you some examples. But like
visual examples? I'll try
that
now. Go ahead. Go on.
Well, like, again, those Chippendales dancers.
Yeah.
I don't know who they think they're fooling. They have gay face. And you don't
see... Okay, I'm seeing pictures on my computer of gay face. I think I know what you mean. At least these four look very bedroom eyes-like. Is that involved?
No. It's all about... It's all a shine, sheen.
Okay, a sheen.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like they're lit from within. It's like they're jack-o'-lanterns, human jack-o'-lanterns.
That is such a stereotype that gay people are lit from within like human jack-o'-lanterns. I won't allow that here. So Theft by Finding was based on diaries that you'd kept since you were 20 years old. This was your last time here in Seattle. You were workshopping that.
Last year. It was a diary. I've been keeping diaries since I was 20. And so it was all going to be one book, but then it was so out of hand. Again, it's not the whole diary. It was just bits from it.
Uh-huh.
But it even the bits got out of hand, and so we broke it into two volumes. And so the first volume was 1977 to 2002, and the next one will be 2003 through 2017 or 18.
How do you keep, when you're David Sedaris, is your diary really a diary? As I would think it's a writer's notebook or something. I mean, what's the difference?
No, I've seen writers. I mean, I carry around a notebook in my pocket.
I see it.
But those are just notes, right? Like just little notes. And when I sit down in my diary in the morning, I look at my notes and I think, and I use them when I'm, like somebody came the other night, a veterinarian came to the reading and she told me about somebody had brought in a puppy and this woman had been breastfeeding the puppy.
Wow.
And she didn't, I found interesting was that she wasn't pumping and then putting into a bottle. She was breastfeeding.
Wet nursing
a puppy. And so someone tells me something like that, I say, hold on while I reach for my notebook.
Yeah, yeah. But when you were writing a diary and you know you publish your diaries, is it the same voice coming out when it's not just between me and my dear diary anymore?
No, but I think that changed more in 1987 or 1986. I was living in Chicago and I was invited to take part in a reading. And it was a kind of a variety show. So there were a number of people taking part. And the woman who put it together said to me, you've got 5 minutes. And I said, well, I have a new story that I'm working on, and that's going to take 17 minutes. So, you know, I'll be 17 minutes. And she said, no, 5 minutes. And it was the best lesson I ever learned, and it was good to learn it early. When people say 5 minutes, they mean 5 minutes. It's not fair to everyone else to go longer than 5 minutes. Mm. So I thought, what am I going to do? So I read things from my diary. Not higgledy-piggledy. I went through it and I thought, oh, that's kind of funny. That might work.
Huh.
And that was the first time I did it. So if anything changed the way I wrote in my diary, it was that.
Right.
Because now when something happens, like when someone says, this woman was breastfeeding a puppy, I'll take special care with it when I write about it. Because I think, oh, this is interesting and funny and this might come in handy later.
By the way, I'd like the person who came to your Seattle show and shared that with you to call us and tell us more about why this woman is breastfeeding a puppy. So that again, that number is 206-543-KUOW. I'm here with David Sedaris, the beloved David Sedaris, if you don't mind, best-selling author. And he's back again, as he was last year, polishing, workshopping. This is not a diary this time. You're reading from your manuscript of Calypso.
Right. It's an essay collection.
Yeah.
But really the book is finished and it's copy edited and, you know, I can still make little changes, but then there were another 15,000 words. There were another like five stories that I've been working on for a long time and I couldn't get quite right. So that's what I'm doing is I'm working on those five stories and the ones that do work, I'm not reading them out loud. Those are done, but right. So I'm just concentrating on what doesn't work.
On these five stories?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you come to Broadway Performance Hall, be honest with David Sedaris. You're not doing him any favors if you don't let him know which of the stories are awful and which are fantastic and ought to be in print. By the way, did you know that the Calypso, Jacques Cousteau's research vessel, I don't know why you named the book Calypso, but that boat was built in Seattle.
Oh, well, yeah.
It was a minesweeper at first.
The title, it didn't come from the Greek myth.
No.
Or from, in one of the essays, I was talking about how, you know, like sometimes you have a cat and your cat will lead a double life and it just goes over to other people's houses and the chances are they could have named it something stupid like Calypso. And so then that became the title for the book.
I saw you, we and I talked about before we came on the radio here that you come back to Seattle. You've been coming here for years, but you came back last year, came this year. I asked you if you brought your rubbish bag because I saw you interviewed at your home in Sussex and you were saying, and you don't leave your house without a rubbish bag there. Surprisingly messy in Sussex. And you were saying you noticed the same thing here. There's... It's a rubbishy place, Seattle?
Well, I don't know what it is in England. And obviously, it's not everyone, but it's a good many people. They just throw everything out the car window.
Yeah.
And
we did that in the 70s, right. I think, when or 60s, yeah, here.
And I live in a beautiful space in the country, a beautiful place and out in the country. And when I moved there, I was shocked by the amount of trash that was everywhere. And so I went to a meeting of the Clean and Tidy Advisory Board in my local council.
Is that real?
Yeah.
Clean and Tidy Advisory Board?
And then everything I suggested, they gave me a reason why it couldn't be done. And I thought, okay, well, I'll just do it myself. So I've picked up so much litter in England that my local council named a garbage truck after me. And I got invited to Buckingham Palace. I've picked up tons and tons and tons. So now I have an eye for everywhere I go, that's what I'm looking for. And I did notice an alarm. If I lived here,
yeah,
I would start at the airport,
mm-hmm.
and I'd, you know, do the whole path into town. I mean, I wouldn't be able to sleep at night knowing. I wasn't expecting it.
Are you hearing that, Seattle? Because we used to think we're the clean city. And, you know, David Sedaris would bring a rubbish bag around if he could.
Well, the thing is, I think people get used to it, and then they don't see it anymore. And I've noticed that in England, one of our neighbors went up to Hugh a while ago and said, you know, certain people don't like it when outsiders come into the area and tell the world that we have a problem with rubbish when we don't. And it's like, well, clearly you do. You just don't.
You need an outsider for that reason.
Yeah, because a lot of times you just don't see it anymore.
Does anybody mind you coming from the... You're not English, and you come to Sussex and start picking up their trash?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The other big anti-litter campaigner there in England is Bill Bryson. And he's American, too.
Uh-huh.
So we're two American scolds, you know, telling people to clean up after themselves. So you have to really watch your tone.
Yes.
You know, you can't be finger-wagging, But the way I look at it, with me, people think, well, he's not just scolding us, he's out there doing it. So
true.
And people see me on the side of the road and they stop me all the time and they say, well done. Or they, you know, they'll give me things like, oh, I saw you a few weeks ago when I've been driving around. I made this jam I wanted to give you, and I've been driving around. Like, this woman gave me this jam and she said, I don't have a proper top for it. I just put some, a sheet of cling wrap over the top. Okay, I'm out there, like, for 7 hours, and you're giving me a jam jar with a lid on it that I'm supposed to hold it in one hand and then crook my trash bag under my arm and then have the grab.
You have to accommodate it. That jar.
But also, we have a big problem in England with, it's called fly tipping. So what people do is, let's say if you were having work done on your house, I would drive by and I would see that you've got a couple of doors and you've got used cement block and bags of concrete. And I'd say, I'll take all of that to the dump for you for $20. And you'd say, great. And you'd give me the $20.
Yeah.
And then I just drive to the country and I dump it.
That's what you do?
No, that's what people do there.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
Wow.
On top of the litter, you go out, and then you've got all of this...
Home construction waste.
Yeah. So I've become like a detective.
Uh-huh.
And I go through it and look for clues. And it took a year, but somebody just got fined £3,000 because I turned him in and I had found all the, you know... the clues. And
did you take it to the police or did you take it to the homeowner and say, guess where your home construction mess ended up?
I took it to the police.
Wow. David Sedaris comes to England and will go and will clean up your neighborhood and bust fly tippers. Wow. You make an impact.
But it's, you know, it really has become my life.
What?
Picking up trash on the side of the road. And people draw their children near when they see me coming. You know, certain people, they think it's my community service, maybe.
Oh, sure. So you're probably a troublemaker who got caught.
I mean, there are people who come up to me and thank me, and then there are an equal number of people who think that I'm crazy, and I may well be.
Right. And what did you do to deserve this?
I just can't pass it by. I can't walk by litter. I can't do it. And it doesn't matter. Gee, on my birthday, it was driving rain. And I went out for 7 hours in the driving rain and picked up trash. And you know how it is, the roads are flooded and then people come speeding by and it's like someone throwing buckets of water on you.
Yeah.
And I thought, how is this my life? Yeah. Like, what a wretched life I have. But at the same time, there's nothing I would have rather been doing.
That's so it.
I've made a wretched life for myself.
Speaking of wretched life, finally, David Sedaris is going to be at Broadway Performance Hall, what, the rest of the week?
Yeah, through Thursday. I mean, Thursday is my last show.
Do Seattleites come up to you and want to hear your expat take on Donald Trump? Is there anything you want? Do you avoid all that? I don't read about politics in your books.
Well, what's interesting to me is in England, I feel like when George Bush was president and I was living in France and then I was living partly in England, all people did was come up and rub my nose in George Bush.
Uh-huh.
And people would be rubbing my nose in Donald Trump, except Brexit happened.
Oh, yeah.
And so now people are like, yeah, it's pretty awful, isn't it? So, I mean, I got it on two countries.
Yes. Wherever you go, there's a populist upswelling.
But Brexit, it's interesting. I have a friend in England I met him because he was on the Clean and Tidy Advisory Board.
Yes, so as we discussed.
I became friends by going out and picking up rubbish. And so we've been doing it for years. And then he ran for office, and I didn't know. Anyway, he ran for office as a Tory, and he voted for Brexit. And so that's interesting to me to have somebody in my life, and I can say, why did you do that? And just to hear it from a different vantage point. And I think, you know, our friendship was established beforehand, so it's kind of great to have him to go to with my questions. And, you know, we're still friends. And everything. I just find it, but I don't know that I have that in America. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know that I have, I mean, there, you know, I'm like everybody. There, you know, winds up there are people in your family who maybe voted differently than you do. But generally speaking, to keep the peace, you just don't talk about that.
Yeah.
But with my friend in England, we can talk about it. Maybe because, I don't know, maybe because it's not really my country, or maybe because the thing about, like, I can't vote in England, so nothing that happens there is my fault.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I don't feel like, it's not like something I fought for and it got, and I lost. It just sort of happened around me and there was nothing I could do.
But you don't vote in America.
Yeah, I vote in America.
Oh, you do?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so President Oprah, that might be something you would actually vote on here in 3 years.
President Oprah, you better believe it. And she gave her, you know, really her first speech of her campaign last night at the Golden Globes. And I got to say, fantastic glasses.
I didn't think fantastic glasses is where you were headed. Yeah, that is an aspect of her, of Oprah and possibly her upcoming campaign.
But I mean, really, I mean, if she was going to run, this would be the perfect time. I mean, you couldn't really, it's not like the president could say you have no experience.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like he could put her down as like a television personality, right? So it's just a vote over which television personality you liked best. And I'll tell you something. I've never met Donald Trump, but I met Oprah Winfrey, and she smells terrific.
Hmm. The glasses and the aroma.
Yep.
Okay. David Sedaris has been writing his own name over and over as we've been speaking for the last several minutes, and he's going to be at Broadway Performance Hall signing, I assume, and Q&A-ing and workshopping and being live on Capitol Hill the rest of this week through Thursday.
Correct.
Great to see you. Celebrity David Sedaris, now eligible to be president of the United States because of celebrity status. And we'd vote for you here. It's always good to see you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Back in just a moment.